If you are a small business owner, I'm sure sometimes you feel like you need a marketing degree just to successfully market your business. I'm here to tell you that is not the case if you use Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning platform has powerful marketing tools to make it easy to grow your audience, engage your customers, and sell more. In just a few clicks, you can launch a campaign that is tailored to your business and goals. Maybe you're launching a new product, or releasing a newsletter, or want to tell your customers about upcoming deals. Constant Contact can help with all of that. This includes email, SMS, social media, and so much more, all designed to be easy so you can sell more, raise more, and fast-track business growth. Plus, Constant Contact's award-winning customer service is there for guidance along the way to help you with things like customer lists, templates, and follow-ups. Get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall.
I'm Adam McGee.
And I'm Andrew Snyder.
And you're listening to Capture and Celluloid on Make Time for This, proudly a part of the Eurostep Podcast Network and the Blue Wire Podcast family. We're back. Events have dragged this one out. We promised this episode would take us longer to get back to it. But here we are. We are here to talk about a film we've talked about before, quite a while back on the podcast. I think the case we're going to make here is that's the greatest concert film ever made. And we're going to talk about concert films and I guess the act of capturing live music on screen too. Of course, it stopped making sense. You'll hear all about all the other films we want to talk about. But first and foremost, Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm great, Adam. Doing well. Glad to be back here with you. As you well know, and some of our listeners may know, music is something that we get to podcast about sometimes, just because of our schedules and because I think the priority should be that this is a movie podcast. We talk about a lot of things, football, golf, things of that nature. But the intersection of music and movies just allows me to combine a love that I don't always get to talk about with the one that we get to talk about regularly. And so I'm happy to be here because I think concert films are their own unique beast, and the greatest of all time is one that you and I are locked in on fully. It's a magical experience seeing this film, and then also, you know, we get to talk about some films that may align with one of our tastes and not the other, or just some that wouldn't be for us necessarily at all that we came away very impressed by. So a genre that I've come to understand I'm very fond of. Even though I think the GOAT is unequivocal, even more than Michael Jordan, anything else, the GOAT is the GOAT.
It's a very tough one to talk about when it comes to movies, concert movies, because I think there's more ambiguity kind of to the genre lines than there is with anything else. We'll get into that when we get to our lists. I don't really think I've got anything that I'm going to be shouting out that is in the kind of music doc branch, where often music docs could be 50, even 60% concert footage. But I think there is a sense of, you know, a concert film when you see it, which is, that's what they say about porn, right, Andrew? That was the definition for it. I think the same is true for a concert film. There's some stuff in here that others might argue, no, it doesn't feel like a concert film to me. I think some kind of recorded all live footage from a TV studio or something like that, that can be a concert film. We'll get into it. We'll talk some more about the nitty and gritty of it all. And, you know, if people are angry, you can let us know. You can let us know if you disagree with our definitions. But you kind of alluded to it there. I mean, we both love live music. We both love concerts. I went to an incredible amount of concerts in my youth. Alas, I am no longer in my youth, Andrew. So I don't go to as many as I used to. I have been trying to ramp that up a bit again. God, my body doesn't take it as well as it used to. But that's, again, conversation for another time. I don't know anyone who goes to more concerts than you, though. So I'm very interested in your perspective on this. I think Stop Making Sense, to kind of to set the table, I think it does some things that make it feel uniquely like you are at the concert. We will be talking, I guess, specifically about theatrical experiences we've just had watching Stop Making Sense and its re-release. We both saw it in IMAX, and I think in that setting, more than anything, I think it's the most I've ever felt like I was at a gig without being at one. But do you get what I'm saying with that? Because even a lot of these, they look beautiful, they sound great. There's a remove, there's a barrier that just stops it from feeling like you're there, that I think somehow John and Demi, Talking Heads, managed to kind of break through and Stop Making Sense.
Yeah, I think there are a few things that make it feel that way. Obviously, it's very kinetic. There's a kinetic energy to the show just because of the movement, the process. It's, you know, very much like a play in some ways, or a performance art piece, and it counts on the players on the stage, and then it also counts on the audience buy-in. There's also a degree of breaking the fourth wall, I think, with the camera. They're not shy about, you know, acknowledging it in some places, and also you're just in the midst of the show so often in a way that I think it's just very powerful and really grabs you, and especially seeing it on the big screen for the first time, the biggest screen possible, I think really makes it feel like you're at a concert. And I've had that sensation watching the film again. I mean, Adam, you don't know this, but some of my work plans that may have me out of town on Thursday, I've just Googled a Stop Making Sense showing, even though I've seen it twice in the last 2 weeks. Maybe I opt for Killers of the Flower Moon, depending on who else in my household wants to see it. But, you know, we'll see. There's just something so special about it. I mean, the way it's unveiled to you as well. And it feels like you're sharing this experience with all the people in the room, because you are in the room, in a sense. And that's very special, because there's something for me about live music that is like no other sort of dopamine hit or serotonin, whatever the word is, some kind of natural high that you get from being in on a shared experience with a bunch of people. Sometimes that can go wrong at speedways in upstate New York or wherever that is. Sometimes that shared experience does not go well. But like, I was at a concert a few weeks ago with this kind of more along the lines of the band's sound, Adam, so what wouldn't be your vibe, an artist called Charles Wesley Godwin, and he's playing in a room that's as small as he'll ever play in again, I would say, based on his career trajectory and his latest album kind of blowing up. And just like everyone in a room singing every word, the people on the stage giving you their all in terms of either the emotion, the passion of their performance, or the choreography, the inventiveness in Stop Making Sense case. That's something that is very tough to take from a room to a screen. And Jonathan Demme and David Byrne, Tina Weymouth, Chris France, and Jerry Hairston, all the Edna Holt was her name, Bernie Worrell, all the people that like made that happen. It's just like a lightning bolt strike that just seems insane, especially after having watched other types of these films just back to back to back. You see how some of them can be very solid. You see how high the barrier is to be transcendent.
Yeah, I mean, to get into territory, which I guess is something of the more familiar for people listening to this podcast, where I go all full auteurist and I start singing the praises of a singular artist and often a director. I do think, and it does seem like it's something that even Talking Heads have been talking about and doing some of their publicity around this re-release, Jonathan Demme is just a colossal part of this. One of the greatest American filmmakers of the 20th and into the 21st century. I think a pretty singular director in terms of a lot of his techniques. And I think some of them, I mean, one of the probably four or five directors, and certainly leaning towards the modern era, one of the best known directors for his work in close-up. And when he goes close up, and he goes close up on David Byrne's face and Stop Making Sense, it really creates something special in a way that I think generally these things are not very cinematic. They are from quite a distance, giving a solid remove. They're wide shots. They'll be heavy cutting, and it'll be like almost rhythmically, okay, cut to guitarist, cut to bassist, cut to drummer, back to vocals, and you're just kind of going around in circles, crowd reaction shot, which is something that I think should rarely be in these things, and I think it's not making sense. It's towards the end when you start to see the crowd. I think to create the impression that the viewer is the crowd is a much, much smarter thing to do. I think the main shot is perfectly positioned to do that, to make us be in this kind of spectator's position of watching from a front row seat or standing in the middle of the audience. But I think it's so well edited, and from, I guess, both Demi's own conception and the band's, and Dave Byrne certainly seem to be pretty particular, like he has probably been on most things in his life, but have very clear ideas about how he wanted this to be captured, how he wanted to look. I think there's some simple things. The building of the stage, the fact that he's just coming out with the tape recorder, like to start things off with Psycho Killer, and the fact that we watch it build from there, the fact that we're seeing crew members on stage, I really do think that is something that's very real and akin to being at a gig. When, you know, that feeling when you're at a gig and it's like, most recent gig I was at the National probably 3 weeks ago, and there is a poor unfortunate guy whose job is to like have to spring into action every time Matt Berninger decides, that's it, I'm going into the crowd to like scream these vocals into someone's faces. And there's someone who's basically chasing him. There's another person who's just like passing mic cable through his hands, just extending and reeling it in from the center of the stage. Like you kind of see a lot of the work as it's happening at a concert. It's part of what makes it special. You feel, yeah, this thing is happening now. There's immediacy. It's being put on for me. Not only are these people performing, but this is a show that's being constructed, and it's, you know, the work is there. And I think elements of the work are certainly there in Stop Making Sense, where, yeah, of course, your eye is drawn to David Byrne or Tina Weymouth or whatever it is. But you're also, you are scanning and you're watching the stage build around. You're thinking, oh, what's coming next? What's going to happen? And of course, there are a couple of tricks up their sleeve in terms of spectacle, in terms of props, that kind of make that payoff even further. But it's the fact that you could feel the show coming together and being constructed, being performed for you, I think is a big deal. And even as I talked about, Demi, known as this master of the close-up, the close-ups I think are really, really effective and important. And not everyone can give you a Demi close-up, but the effect I think they have, and I felt this particularly when you're watching in IMAX, you see David Byrne's face like blown up colossally with this great, beautiful close-up on a big screen. What's it like? It's like being at a concert and there's, you know, a big screen and you'll see close-ups of the band's face or whatever. It's the kind of thing that when you're at a concert, you might experience, and it's there in your periphery. It's kind of part of the overall presence. But when you watch a lot of this, or if you watch live, I don't know if this is something that happens. I mean, the BBC do a lot of this from Glastonbury, from Reading and Leeds, from multiple festivals, where they will actually basically give over significant, certainly their primetime slots, to showing live festival coverage. Does that happen in the US on any like traditional either network or cable like TV stations? Is there any like legacy of, oh, here's, you know, Lollapalooza, for example, and there's going to be, you know, we're going to pick out, you know, headliners or whatever, even at minimum, and their sets are going to be live? Because it's one of those things that does happen quite a lot, I think, in the UK. And to me, it always seems like a no-brainer. It's like, it's even, I'd kind of come festival season, there could be bands like that my parents have no idea about. They will happily sit down and be like, oh, there's live music on TV. Like, who doesn't kind of like that or get something out of that? Not really a thing over there?
Not that I can really remember. And if one of our many listeners, especially the one that won the Phoenix Blu-ray Criterion, if they know, feel free to tweet at us. But like, I'll go to the Glastonbury YouTube whenever it's happening, when they give me the ones. Like, I think last year I remember like trying to watch as many, and I could be misremembering, Haim live performances as I could.
Yeah,
I
feel like I got last year, this year. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I've seen that performance of The Steps or Gasoline or The Wire many times. But yeah, it's a thing I'm in for. So if I've turned on whatever channel and they wanted to give me Lollapalooza or Bonnaroo, and I think they probably still do on the YouTube, but like I'm not the YouTube. What am I, 90 years old?
but it's like, not even like you. Sure, a lot of that lives on. You get those sets, but it's like, again, I'll shout out BBC because they do this very well, and it probably helps the kind of legacy they have through the radio channels, like built into being, yes, this arm of like discovery for music in the UK, but obviously more globally too, because they're the BBC. So like, let's say on their main shows for Glastonbury, yeah, you could have Elton John as the headliner and they're going to show you the full Elton John set. But before and after that, they'll go around a bunch of the stages and you'll hear a song here or there from bands or artists that are in completely different places on their journeys. And I think it just tends to be pretty cool. It's like, this is interesting. We're talking about this at the moment, and the biggest movie in the world is Taylor Swift's The Eras Tour. And neither of us have seen it. I am right. You haven't seen that tour itself. You didn't see Taylor Swift live on this tour.
No, I saw this. I price gouge people. It's fine.
That's okay. If ever there was, you know, a time where it was appropriate, where, you know, money might just be too good to turn down, it probably was that one.
It also coincided with the time I was laid off from work. So really,
okay. Listen, you earned it.
I'm an idiot if I didn't do that.
I think, though, I'll be honest, I will watch that eventually, and I am not a Taylor Swift fan in any way, and I have not enjoyed things I have watched previously from, like, the Taylor Swift, you know, arm of here's my music in sort of filmic form. But I'm fascinated because that thing has been basically the cultural sensation of the year globally. And we'll continue into next year when, like, it eventually makes its way to places like Ireland and throughout the rest of Europe. I was going to go and see it in cinemas, and then I realized I don't think I can hack it when I start to see videos of what that was like. Now, that's cool. That's what that's like for all those people. It's like, stop making sense. Screenings can have elements of that, but it feels like there are levels here. And with an artist that I don't have any real feeling about, and it would be more curiosity and kind of like, what is it I'm missing out on? I wonder, can I get it this time that I'd be going to see it for? I don't think that would be the environment I'd thrive in. But all of this is to say, like, Stop Making Sense is re-released. You're talking about still being able to go and see it. Like, it's out weeks and weeks. So it's the same here. It's out weeks. It's still playing. People are still going to see it. Like, it could play for months and months. It could probably just play permanently all over the world. And there will be people every week who be like, yeah, let's go see Stop Making Sense. Obviously, the level of the Taylor Swift phenomenon is different, but people are showing up. They're going to see that. Like, there is a clear desire for this. Most of the time, it is not going to be done even remotely as artfully as it was done in Stop Making Sense. But, like, people like to go and watch live music. And if you're not going and seeing the show in person, the next best thing is, oh, you can go and see it communally on a big screen with great speakers. I think it would be great if there were more artists like thinking of this in a serious way. Like, if Taylor Swift had used that opportunity and said, I'm going to get the best filmmaker I can get in here. We're going to talk this through. We're going to make the best film we can make of this. Then, you know, I'd probably put up whatever I had to put up with. I'd be like, sick. I think that could be interesting for music and for movies if more artists look at something like Stop Making Sense and are like, god, wouldn't it be great if we have like an artifact of our tour, not just of our tour but of our band? Like, that is the legacy of Talking Heads long after they're broken up, and people can go and see it and soak it up, and it stands as its own piece of art within our larger body of work, rather than here's, you know, an extension of that that's going to make us more money.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. In hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. Win. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Yeah, I'll see it at some point. I wanted to let like the hardcore fans have their thing.
And is that ever gonna have died down though with that artist?
Therein lies the question. But if I go and I choose to go and all the like, I'm sure I'm gonna enjoy a lot of it. The songs that I like, not the songs from Midnights, which I tried to talk myself into being good when I was, you know, you're Sonic first, Adam. I think I'm lyrics first. And then I heard some of the lyrics on that album. I was like, that doesn't work, but you know, I'm just going to get in on the journey. And then, so all the songs that aren't on that album, especially the songs where Aaron Dessner made her sound like a divorced dad, those are the ones that really live with my spirit that I love a lot. I'll enjoy all of that. And you know, if I've not waited too long, or if it's just unavoidable and the people are, you know, dancing and screaming in the aisles, like I kind of just got to let them have their thing and understand that that's not for me. And, it's funny, 'cause normally like at a concert, I'm like, you know what, as long as you're not bothering anyone, do your own thing. But for some reason in the movie theater setting, it's like old man, get off my lawn sort of thing. But that being said, you know, I understand, I gotta let them have their thing. But yeah, that is something that is a very interesting point you make. And I think, does Beyonce have another concert film coming out later this year? I thought I was reading.
I believe December, yeah.
She had one in 2019-ish, somewhere around then as well. If this is something that the re-release of Stop Making Sense and Taylor Swift's success with this like brings back to the forefront and more artists and diverse types of artists start to make this a regular thing, if it becomes something that can be profitable for people, which is kind of like the driving decision maker, I would be in on that, having like a couple of these a year. I think about a documentary that was really solid this year from HBO Max, which was Jason Isbell's Running With Our Eyes Closed, directed by Sam Jones. I think that is a film that could have been like amped up by some of the live performances.
He's making some good director friends too. You know, maybe he could have enlisted someone. Could have got Scorsese. No one loves making a music documentary or a concert film more than Scorsese. So he could have maybe parlayed his Killers of the Flower Moon work into that.
Listen, musically, that kind of works on the same wavelength too. The band were like, I don't know if they were largely Canadian, but that Americana style that has been the new term catch-all for most of the people that I listen to, you know, that kind of fits. Marty, where's my Isbell concert doc?
Well, like to give an example, so there is a working director I can think of right off the bat. I'm like, he does a lot of music stuff, has a very close relationship with a certain band, and also happens to be like someone who Jonathan Demme was his idol, and he tries to emulate at every turn. That's Paul Thomas Anderson. Like, he's done a lot of stuff with Haim. But that kind of leveling up of that seems kind of like a logical progression. Now, PTA did have Janun. I don't know if you ever got around seeing Janun, which is just It's so good when Johnny Greenwood was like playing with Janon, and more documentary certainly than concert film in that case. But he has kind of dipped his toe into this world before. Haim are a band that they're not Taylor Swift, but they are associated with Taylor Swift, and like by association, they're kind of in the spot, like a Talking Head spot, where it's like they're big enough, but there's also something kind of individualistic enough and artistic enough that there's room. I just think things like that are easy, like in an even time sense, for a lot of directors, and could be an interesting space where these two art forms, which face incredible challenges in making money compared to what they once did, could possibly mesh together and further bolster each other, and in ways that are really creatively interesting.
That episode, I think we need to do in person, because you're going to need a spray bottle or a newspaper or something to just hit me whenever I'm about to, you know, just be so overt in my praise because of how much I love that band. I still haven't seen them live, but I look forward to one day getting to a Haim concert. And I would love to see the PTA-directed Haim concert film. Sign me up.
I mean, he's done lots of, like, studio, you know, videos. He's done lots of stuff with them to this point. What seemed like a cool progression. We'll see. Tracks. What kind of stood out to you this time? Was there anything different, or what from your viewings of Stop Making Sense this time out was really the kind of the moments for you, or your favorite moments of the film?
So I think, like I said, the structure of it remains something that I really like and really respect. It's just the band is unveiled piece by piece, and then it builds up to just like a crescendo with burning down the house, and then goes on from there. I think like there's no bigger like joyful thing for me in any, I don't want to say any walk of life, but just when we get to Life During Wartime, and just the whole choreographed nature of that song. It's not even the big suit for me later on in the show. It's the
running on the spot during Life During
Wartime. Yeah, the running on the spot during that.
I mean, he also does run around the entire band at a point in that.
Yes.
Well.
Yes. And just the choreographed nature of that, and just how, for whatever reason, exhilarating it is. And I think something that, it was just so apparent in every time I watch this, but especially this one, it's just Lynn Mabry and Edna Holt are just essential in this entire thing. They are not background singers. They are part of the band in this, and just like help make it what it is. The framing of David Byrne when he's doing sort of the, I don't know how to describe it, the clothesline, like not robot back and forth kind of a shimmy that is one of the major gifts associated with this if you see it somewhere. Another just like great moment for me. And you know, Once in a Lifetime is probably one of their top three or four songs in popularity ever, and there's a reason. It's fantastic. Let's see. I mean, I love the start when we get the breathless kind of tribute there with the stumbling around or whatever I've seen it called. So I love that. I love all of it, but I'll stop talking now.
No, that's okay. You don't have to stop talking. You're here to talk. That's the whole idea of it. I remain kind of unmoved that This Must Be the Place is one of my favorite songs of all time, and that performance and everything with the lamp is,
oh yes,
like that's the thing here too, when we talk about all the staging, and this can't be any simpler. Like, this is like a blank warehouse stage, and the kind of props that come in, a giant suit, a lamp, like a tape recorder, like this is like as basic and as low budget as it can get. That's just so effective. This Must Be the Place, I think, is just an incredibly special few minutes of any film ever. I think you're right to call it Life During Wartime. So I think the point you're making, you could really say anything here. I love Genius of Love, and I just love that structuring of it as well. And again, as this becoming this kind of, I guess, snapshot of the Talking Heads' legacy in some way, that we do have this moment where just one of the all-time great pop songs and a song that was sampled to, you know, to massive success and fortune for the Tom Tom Club and for that portion of the band, to just see that performance of, which I think is fantastic. It's a great song and it's a really good performance. In spite of, I think, maybe, you know, some of the best efforts of Chris France and is just shouting stuff out, it works. It's just like, that's what Genius of Love is, so it works. But otherwise, you're like, ugh. I love that section, because to go from that, and you're like, oh, this thing is great in its own two footing, and it stands there as, yeah, the band is starting to splinter. They're playing their song while David Byrne goes backstage to change into a giant suit to do the rest of this. I just think, though, that has, like, a whole run true. And I feel like after that, you're getting, like, ugh. Girlfriend is Better might be next. Take Me to the River, like Cross Eyed and Painless. I feel like they're the giant suit songs. Maybe is Imbra. That might be just before that. I can't remember. But that's just as a kind of a run, and like this incredible insight into the whole trajectory of this band. It's both where they're at in that moment, but it's also like you can just parse through everything they were, so much of what they were sonically, then the individual dynamics. I think it can't be understated just how good this band were as performers. You talk about, you know, it being so much more than just, you know, basically what in other bands would be backing vocalists or touring musicians coming in. It's like the way their band got filled out, and that was... like, that whole band was talking heads for this is a big deal. But for as much as everyone talks about, like, the way David Byrne moves, it's like, Tina Weymouth, there's so much to be said for, like, you know where she spreads her legs and she's, like, down low and she's, like, basically playing the bass down, like, at her knees and kind of doing this weird kind of dance. Like, these just weird animalistic movements that she has too, which are just, like, as something on screen, purely magnetic. You're, like, drawn to it, you're straight in. I think there's so much of that, and the scale of the band, the scale sonically of what's happening here, really just, it drags you in. It, like, it's just all enveloping. Honestly, one of the very best big screen experiences I've ever had. Seeing this film there, and like I already seen it, I already loved it, listened to it up loud at home on, you know, good surround sound. Obviously that does not compare to seeing it in IMAX, and it's just something that I don't think anyone's ever come close to, and it's almost like no one has even tried, that they're just like, yeah, well, Stop Making Sense is entirely its own thing. You'll never have a collection of, you know, a band and a filmmaker of that caliber where the moment is perfect and everything clicks. It also just doesn't feel like people try. It doesn't feel like concert films are, you know, constructed or thought of in that way all that often now, which is unfortunate. As we mentioned, it could be an opportunity. It'd be nice to see, and maybe if we're going to have more and more and more of these, if the Eras Tour film really kind of does its share in terms of making money and more artists look to go this route, that's beneficial to theaters. I guess that will open the door for more creativity. And at some point, someone will be like, hey, I know this director. I know this cinematographer. Why don't we team up and be like, what can we do here? What kind of cool thing could we do that makes for a really great film? Any more thoughts on Stop Making Sense?
No, I just want to encourage people to see it.
We did this. We are men of our word. We're not just saying we want to encourage people to see it. We set up two of our friends,
yes,
to essentially go on a bro date and see this. Two fellow GSPNers, the hosts of Talking to Tundra, Numak and Jordan Tresky, went along to see Stop Making Sense for the first time in the presence of Jerry Harrison in his native Milwaukee. Played at the Oriental Theater, a place that you and I were very happy to stop off and sample on our trip to Milwaukee earlier in the year, and they both loved it. And I think probably with some degree of skepticism, which I get when people are like, it doesn't matter if you don't like this band or you don't know this band super well, this is like one of the best things you're going to see. This is an incredible experience. Go see it. Go see it. I think there's only so much of that you can hear and like take seriously. But from what they reported back, it seems like, yeah, okay, we fully get it. And we had an incredible time. Like it works. It's an incredibly powerful work.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a reason. I think this was offline again. I remember I had seen it obviously a few weeks ago in IMAX, and I was crunching tape last night. See how the sausage is made, watching a lot of concert films, and I meant to just kind of scroll through the copy of Stop Making Sense I own on Prime or whatever, and just like hit the hits. Get to, like I said, Life During Wartime, or Burning Down the House, Once in a Lifetime, and then the big suit songs. Instead, I just sat through the entire thing and watched it in full again. And yeah, even if you're not necessarily considering yourself the biggest Talking Head fans, what this is as an achievement in filmmaking and just like performers at the top of their game, just knocking it out of the park. And obviously David Byrne has gone on to have a second life in a number of different ways. And got it as close as you could possibly get to something like this with American Utopia, but this was clearly a band with a complicated relationship among each other. But when they got together to do their thing, they were very special.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I think you hit on something important there, which is this sense that I'm going to talk about when we talk about some other concert films, of like kind of capturing the lightning in the bottle, capturing the magic of a band where someone can see it all these years later and be like, whoa, yeah, I get it. I get why that band is a thing, or that makes me want to go and listen to them now. I think that's very rare. It's like, that should be the kind of thing that's just like the most accessible quality of a concert film. It doesn't always translate. A lot of it can fall flat. When you get it, though, it's like, God, from any period of time, you're like, okay, I can see how that person was like a superstar. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a couple of moments. We didn't necessarily do top fives, top tens. It's kind of tough with what these are, but I'll throw it to you first. What concert films did you want to shout out or bring to the table here as others you really like?
Yeah, my runner-up distantly is one you knew I was going to shout out first, but it's The Last Waltz, Martin Scorsese. Kind of the last hurrah from Canadian and American band, The Band, which was their name. A fascinating group, just from like a human study situation. Canadians, Rick Danko, Garth Hudson, Richard Manuel, Robbie Robertson, and then a guy from the South, from Elaine, Arkansas, Levon Helm, who's the drummer and lead singer to a degree. A lot of people sang songs. I think Danko got some lead vocals in on various songs as well. But just a unique mix of guys who were together in that iteration as like that band for a relatively short period when you consider how some of these legacy bands are kind of going on. I think in the the documentary, Robbie Robertson keeps making note that it's been 16 years on the road and he's ready to get off of it, and everyone else disagrees with him. And knowing that backdrop all these years later makes it a very fascinating piece of history at where they were at the time, and just like the kind of degrees of success and failures that people would have once they split apart from one another. Robbie Robertson died in August just this year. Levon Helm died at 71 in 2012. Garth Hudson, I think, is the only surviving member. Rick Danko died at age 55 in 1999. And I'm pretty sure Richard Manuel is dead as well. It's just a band with a troubled history meeting their endpoint. Yeah, Manuel died in 86 at 42. So drug use rampant among some members. Martin Scorsese admitted to using cocaine heavily at the time of making the movie. And why I say it represents a cultural moment in time is just like kind of the guests that they invite to this last concert, and it turns into kind of a celebration. Ronnie Hawkins, who was the lead singer of the band they originally were the backing band of, the Hawks, they were a backing band of Bob Dylan for a time in the mid-60s. We get Neil Young popping up to sing Helpless. Joni Mitchell comes out to sing Coyote. Paul Butterfield, Muddy Waters, Eric Clapton, Van Morrison, Bob Dylan himself. It was said at the time that Dylan at one point did not want his performances to be filmed, but the film getting made was contingent on Bob Dylan having those performances filmed. So contentious, a band filled with kind of a unique history, and seeing them fall apart after this, it's just an interesting marker in time. And obviously, if you're not into that kind of more of Americana country sound, it's not going to resonate as much with you. But I think from a filmmaking perspective, I have some issues with it. I don't love the, or one of my favorite performances is when they play The Wait with the Staples family. And that was filmed on the soundstage, I believe, and not the version in the concert. And I think the film succeeds when they're in that kind of beautiful room and all together, and they just keep inviting famous friend after famous friend up on the stage. But yeah, Joni Mitchell, one of my favorite artists. I was listening to Both Sides Now on the way home in the Uber when I was ever as well. But I had to pull it up on YouTube because she's off Spotify, so that was the whole thing. But anyway, yeah, just not the best overall in kind of this genre, but a very, very solid high-level film from a obviously high-level director who we'll talk about next week. Also, I want to shout out one of the other and I tried to verify this, but I could not get in touch with the person I need to verify. Evangeline, I don't know how that name is pronounced in the song, that they perform with Emmylou Harris. My great aunt swears that we are related to Emmylou Harris. So a Snyder relative, potentially, on the screen here. Alabama's finest, Emmylou Harris. I don't, you know, who knows? Maybe that's why I like it.
In a Scorsese picture, no less.
Yes.
This is, you've been keeping this secret for quite some time. I just have no existing relationship to the band. I don't think I've ever, like, knowingly been like, oh, that's the band. And maybe I haven't heard it because the music doesn't translate, or that, you know, hasn't kind of made it across here in the same way. There aren't many bands of that era, certainly with that kind of footprint, that I think that's true for. And I think the film speaks kind of for their impact and their legacy its own right, when it is just like almost comical, the level of who's who of music of that time that they're wheeling out, which I think gets to its most ridiculous when it's not like, oh, here's Neil Young come to sing a song, or here's Joni Mitchell, but says just like, oh yeah, we got like Ringo Starr and Ron Wood are here. And you're like, oh, you're just adding musicians from everywhere. It's like, here's a Beatle and here's a Rolling Stone. I think it's really, really interesting in its construction. I just wish I knew the band better to be able to kind of engage with it on a deeper level. Because I love all the little snippets with Scorsese and how he's kind of positioned into it. I love how it builds. This is something that, as I mentioned, like, and just an endless fascination for Scorsese. He's made multiple Bob Dylan films, his most recent which being just maybe one of the most formally like bold and innovative things he's ever made. He just at any available opportunity, Rolling Stones, whoever it might be, he will go and he will direct a concert film. But this is the one he's most famous for. This is the one with the reputation, and it's not artsy why for who's there. Yeah, just the band aren't a band that I really know all that well. So I watched it for the first time for this. A couple of things, I guess, coming together, because over the next week, I think I got to fill in those few gaps that are in my Scorsese viewing history. Maybe we do Killers of the Flower Moon next week, and the following week we do a ranking Scorsese episode, because I think it would be dumb to try and do those two things all at once, like a 3.5-hour movie and then a 50-plus feature career. But yeah, clearly a really, really special work. Just a tougher one for me when it comes to the subject, I guess.
Yeah, the only reason I...
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, the only reason I knew about them is that, because obviously they stopped touring, I'm pretty sure, as a group after The Last Waltz, and then I think they released another studio album or two, I can't remember. And then they reformed as a band in 83, and then in 86, Richard Manuel, who's one of those subjects you get, I think he's the long-haired guy that you get some of the more exuberant snippets of, hanged himself on tour, I think, in his motel room, and that kind of, so it's just a band with like a lot of dark ties to them as well. But the reason I said all that is Jason Isbell, when he was with the Drive-By Truckers on the album Dirty South, had a song called Danko Manuel. And so, I was Googling, are these real people? And then I, started to listen to them, and I was like, oh, how did I not know this band is this? Oh, because all this crazy shit happened after they were at, the peak of their powers in the late 70s. But anyway, others I wanted to shout out, if you just like Fleetwood Mac, the dance, it's not particularly well shot or that interesting, but they play all their hits a little bit past their prime, and it's after they had been broken up after some kerfuffles and drug addictions and all of that. Similarly, I don't think it looks the best of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. I mean, anytime Bowie's going to play Moon Age Daydream and we get the guitar from, Mick Ronson, I think, is his lead guitar player during that era or whatever. Some great, just a great performer, just kind of grappling with what he is as a performer. And I think I'm Bowie pilled after seeing Moon Age Daydream. So that kind of helped me really embrace that experience, even if it, wasn't up to the par of a Stop Making Sense.
And for me, something that we talked about in under the guise of a fiction film that came out last year, I don't know, we may end up talking about it again soon. Elvis 68 Comeback Special. This is both a TV special and a TV studio. It's also kind of undeniably concert to me, though. I mean, some of it you've got him standing in the midst of a crowd performing. Just truly iconic. And one of those things, Stop Making Sense, another couple of things I'm going to talk about, I just think the power of Elvis is immediately apparent when you watch it. You're like, God, I hear how he sounds. I could see how he looks, how he moves. The appeal is just obvious. And just as this kind of, this artifact, frozen in amber as such, that you can just be like, there you go. This is what Elvis was, and this is why Elvis was such a big deal. I think it really plays, and I think it's one of the most watchable things you could see. If you've never seen it before, maybe you've seen... I feel like everyone's seen imagery from it or will have seen clips of it. Of course, there were some really good in terms of loyal recreations of the sets and everything for Baz Luhrmann's movie last year. But the Comeback Special, just it stands up at its own 2 feet. Really, really great work. D.A. Pennebaker's Monterey Pop from the 1967 Monterey International Pop Festival. This is another of these that is kind of who's who. And if I was to have one complaint, it's that we're just jumping around and we're getting one track from a lot of the artists we want more. Thankfully, there is, you know, there is a solution for that with some key examples, which I'll get to. But I mean, going through the list of who you're going to see here, like the Mamas and the Papas, Simon and Garfunkel, Jefferson Airplane, you get The Who, you got Otis Redding, Jimi Hendrix Experience, close out with Ravi Shankar, really incredible performance. Janis Joplin's in there, like just so much great stuff. And again, like 1968, if we want to talk, you know, I mean, Woodstock is another famous concert film for around this time, but just trying to kind of get a snapshot of a key cultural moment. There aren't too many better than Monterey Pop, both in terms of the stardom of a lot of people performing on the bill and about to kind of launch off into a different stratosphere. But then also just like the cultural moment, the cultural movements. I will say, Otis Redding performing Shake and I've Been Loving You Too Long are two of the greatest performances I've ever seen. And there is about a 23-24 minute separate film of Otis live at Monterey, which is basically extended from this, much like there is a Jimi Hendrix live at Monterey extended from this, which is like 40 minutes. Both films are currently on the Criterion Channel, and if you checked out Monterey Pop before, you're going to do it now. I would recommend that when you do that, you then go and you watch those two follow-ups. I think that, like, if I was to find something that, like, stands up with Stop Making Sense, it really might be Otis at Monterey, and it's like 23 minutes. But I have never seen something where you just quite feel like you're being blown away by this whirlwind of like completely inconceivable talent. And then it really, you know, it's not that long after that. You're right towards the end of his career, the end of his life, where he tragically dies in a plane crash. But just like Otis Redding, someone who I've listened to and I've really liked his music over the years, but I've never, show me a different side, like a different, like the performer element where you're like, whoa, like, this is a force of nature. This is a charisma and a vocal ability that's just beyond anything I'd even already comprehended in regard to him. So really recommend Monterey Pop, but also those two kind of extensions, like Jimi Hendrix, obviously at Monterey is iconic and people have seen so much of the footage of that. Again, like, you know, setting his guitar on fire and things like that. Just unbelievably cool. Like if to fully understand, like, what was the big deal about Jimi Hendrix? I think it's one thing to listen to Jimi Hendrix and it's another to capture kind of the moment like this. And Pennebaker, one of the greatest documentarians of all time, famous for his work with Bob Dylan too, but does an exceptional job. And I think his kind of documentary cinema is, you know, pretty perfect fit for just giving us a sense of what it was like to be in that place at that time with those artists. Long-time listeners, and we're going back 5 years now, will have heard me in my best of list, whenever that was, really sing the praises of Amazing Grace, an Aretha Franklin documentary that came out in 2018. It was originally directed, meaning when it was shot, it was directed by Sidney Pollack, only further to be colossal problems with syncing the audio and the picture and the film spending a long time, I believe in total 35 years, just completely locked away in a Warner Brothers vault with nothing happening with it. Alan Elliott purchased the footage from Warner Brothers and then basically edited, restored, worked his way through the footage to create one of the greatest concert films ever. I think one of the greatest, kind of most singular examples of just what vocal ability can look and sound like, and it's just a fascinating piece of cinema, like a piece of documentary that moving around those rooms and looking at the people in that space and examining the world that Aretha Franklin came up in and the world that she was then a part of. So you've got the influence of the church, the influence of her father, but then you've also got people like Mick Jagger and I think Paul McCartney, if memory serves me right. Maybe I'm wrong, McCartney, but certainly Mick Jagger, who are like also there to check out what Aretha Franklin is doing at the time. Just an unbelievable documentary film. You could do so much worse at any time than sit down for 90 minutes of listening to Aretha Franklin just like kind of blow you away. That's what Amazing Grace is. Other than that, I mean, it's getting into like shouting out some favorites. The Rooftop Concert from Get Back, you know, that remastered footage that Peter Jackson just did, and I'm putting together the Rooftop Concert full. Something I think people have seen snippets of plenty of times over the years. Great to have it all as one, and to have a Beatles performance and the last Beatles performance available like that. You shouted out earlier, like before we even got to this stage, David Byrne's American Utopia. We did a pod on that at the time. That's probably when we last spoke about Stop Making Sense. But Spike Lee directing that concert film of that show on Broadway. Honestly, just, again, you could, any day you'd need a, you know, a bit more pep in your step, or you need to just switch off and go somewhere else, American Utopia can certainly help you with that. Questlove's Summer of Soul, out a couple of years ago, I'd highly recommend. And I guess just things like that come down to my own personal taste. Pixies, one of my all-time favorite bands. They've had a great concert film, Live from the Newport Folk Festival, a fully acoustic set they did there. I love Radiohead's In Rainbows from the Basement, which that's probably getting into the, is this a concert film? Is it a TV special? That kind of blurred line. Something like Nirvana Unplugged for MTV in New York, that probably gets into that space too. Arctic Monkeys at the Apollo, directed by Richard Ayoade. That's actually a pretty good one. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. I mean, I think we've mentioned a lot of the major ones. Gimme Shelter is one we haven't mentioned there. I think Gimme Shelter will usually come up at the top of these lists. It doesn't feel like the best of the Rolling Stones to me. It doesn't feel like the most iconic kind of, or the perfect snapshot of them, but it's an incredible film for what's being captured with the Hells Angels offstage, and obviously really shows something of a cultural moment in a pretty harsh and unblinking light that's very important too. But yeah, I think that's what I've got in terms of the overall outlook here. There's some things that I, you know, I love to take in a good concert film, whether it be a band that I love, an artist that I love, or to kind of have your eyes open to someone, see them in an entirely new way, which is what happens when you see, you know, plenty of artists perform live and you're like, whoa, that's different to what I had in my head. That's so much better than what I thought this person was from hearing them recorded. So yeah, I'd be all for more concert films, better concert films. Let's create some stuff that is worth kind of the curiosity rather than just, oh, that band just kind of filmed the concert.
I've heard or read this latest concert film described as like a credit card commercial if it was a concert film. So I await your viewing of it, and then we can see if these are trending in the right direction.
You're talking about the Taylor Swift Eras Tour film?
Yeah, don't Beetlejuice this, Adam.
You weren't brave enough to say it, just in case, you know. I don't know. Is there bots?
I've called out a
podcasts?
Lot of people today. I've called out
you're
a
not,
lot of people.
You're not prepared for that one, though. That I understand. No. I mean, you're one of them too. Like you're a fan. You should get in front of that and hold your hands up. And you are a fan of Taylor Swift. You've seen Taylor Swift live.
No, I have never seen her live.
Oh, you've never. Okay, you should have along with it. They're gonna come for you now.
you know, if you guys want to listen to Folklore with me, sit around a fireplace. Happy to do it. With some, you know, rosé or whatever.
There you go. Open invitation from Andrew to all of the world Swifties to listen to Folklore with rosé. On that note, I think that pretty much does it. We'll be back next week to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, the new film from Martin Scorsese. How exciting is that? We don't get to say things like that too often. I can't wait. Can't wait to see it. Can't wait to talk about it. Can't wait to think about it. Yeah, tentatively, you know what? I think we might continue and do another Martin Scorsese pod the week after that and maybe come up with our own rankings. Top 10s feel possibly more appropriate in this case. But maybe we talk through. We could do top 5s, but maybe we talk through the filmography in a broader way to kind of talk about some of the So the wider kind of spanning elements of his career.
I'm going to start slicing my garlic now with my razor blade.
And yeah, that's lots of other good stuff to come. Good movies coming out. It's a good time of year. I think since we last recorded, the WGA strike came to an end. Hopefully SAG strike comes to an end and is resolved to the benefit of the actor soon enough. And then everything can kind of get back up and running and we can get all the movies that are on the slate to come out in the next few months. But yeah, good times for movies, good times for the podcast. As always, to never miss an episode, subscribe where you get your podcasts. That's about make time for this. You should also check out the rest of the GSPN podcast. That's the Eurosnet Podcast Network for all things Milwaukee Bucks. Talk to Tundra for everything Green Bay Packers. Cruising for a Bruising for all things Milwaukee Brewers. Until next time, thanks again to you for listening. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Adam.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.